It's a loaded question when anybody asks it, can you keep a secret? Maybe the bigger question for many of us is, do you keep a secret? Today's guest relates the stories of people who did keep secrets and in many cases kept them for a very, very long time. And the secret keeping, compounded by lies, rearranged the lives of both secret keeper and secret finder once the secret was out. Infidelity, adoption, sexuality, several circumstances for keeping secrets are covered in the book Secrets and Lies, Surviving the Truths That Changed Our Lives. Jane Isay wrote the book. She's a former book editor herself and publisher in New York City and the author of a pair of previous books about adults and families, Walking on Eggshells and Mom Still Likes You Best. Jane Isay, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Can we assume that years of exposure to psychology and psychologists sort of helped the process of this book coming to fore?
Oh, yes. You know, I was lucky enough to publish and work with psychologists, evolutionary scientists, and neurobiologists, all of whom informed me terrifically about what are the human elements that cause us to behave the way we behave. And so when it came to Secrets and Lies, I had a very good understanding from my authors and from my reading of what the dynamics of this are.
And it's a lot bigger. I mean, as we pointed out already, just with a little teaser there, that we're not talking like I took $5 from your purse. I mean, these are big secrets. And can you give us a short list of the sorts of circumstances?
Well, the first chapter includes a story of a woman who got an anonymous letter telling her she was adopted. Another woman whose father, they'd been estranged for years, but they got together when he was very old. And they were looking at family pictures, and he said, "Oh, Maria, I love you so much." And she said, "Me too, Dad." And he said, "I love you as much as if you were my daughter." There's a story. And then the third one in that chapter is a woman who was raised by a single mother. Her father had died in World War II until she was 36, and her mother called her up on the porch of her house and said, "I got to tell you something. Your dad isn't as dead as you thought he was." So that's the first batch of secrets. And then you have secrets about discovering relatives you never thought you had. And then there are stories about children. I have a chapter called The Little Detective, and that's about children who sense that something's funny and they get to the truth or a version of the truth. Kids don't have a full understanding of contexts, but there are some kids who trust their own instincts enough to follow the clues. And then there are the secrets that are lying in plain sight. In many families, and this is a really tough one, if something terrible happens, everybody says we won't talk about it, and nobody can talk about it. And that really is a problem, because if you can't talk about something that's really so important, then you lose your closeness and the intimacy of your family.
That's an interesting subcategory, because this is something that was, I mean, it happened. Everybody was aware of it at the time, but it becomes a secret over time because no one will talk about it.
Yeah, and it's really the chapter of that, the title of that chapter is If You See Something, Say Something. And I've found that not when the parents say in a family, we'll never discuss this again. And often it's a number of cases that people I interviewed, it was, we'll never discuss the death of your sister or brother, imagine. It just tears people apart, because not being able to talk about something that is so important and so heartbreaking and so full of emotion is it's a very painful thing. That relates, of course, to the stories in the rest of the book about people who have kept their own secrets and find themselves pining for the authenticity that comes from revelation. And then, of course, I have a chapter on adultery. And those secrets, my wife has been sleeping with a babysitter, or my husband has been having affairs every week since we were married. Those kinds of secrets, when they come out, have an interesting duality. Because on the one hand, they've been doing something, the spouses have been straying. On the other hand, there's a certain level of denial that takes place on the part of the spouse who's being betrayed, because there generally are clues, But when you're stuck, when you are decided and determined to stay in a marriage, you can be in denial. And that is a very interesting interchange between deceit and denial.
In a sense that you're keeping a secret from yourself.
From yourself, yes. Yes, and so, and that, so, and we are capable of all these things. We're capable, one of the things I learned is that people have been having sex since the beginning of the human species.
Get out.
You know, I hate to say, you're on the West Coast. You may understand that.
I'll have to ask you where that comment came from. But on the other side of a break, Jane Isay is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Secrets and Lies, Surviving the Truths That Changed Our Lives. And as while we're giggling at the moment, the fact is this is some pretty heavy stuff. And we will get more into the contents of the book and the things that Jane found out about a lot of these case histories. She talked to a lot of people and has a secret that was kept from her for many years as well to talk about. That's all coming up on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join this conversation back with Jane Isay and you on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is the author Jane Isay. She's written the book Secrets and Lies, Surviving the Truths That Change Our Lives. And it's about keeping big secrets, infidelities and homosexuality and blended families and unblended families. All these sorts of things are discussed in the book with lots of case histories. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we discuss the effects of secret keeping on both keeper and finder, as Jane puts it. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Our email, jx@jeffnet.org. Jane, you write on page one about the need we have to stay connected to the people we have wronged by our secrets and the people who have wronged us by hiding the truth from us.
Yes.
The need to stay connected. It's not just as easy as saying, I'm out of here.
Well, you know, it's something that I experienced myself, but I've also learned from all the research I've done. You can't really be betrayed by somebody who isn't really important to you. You know, somebody tells your secret or somebody lies to you or in the office or, you know, on the wherever, in a party, you may be annoyed, but it doesn't break your heart. The people who are closest to us, we need. The physiology, the science, medicine, we know that we are a social animal and that we need intimacy. That's how old people live and so on and so on. We know all that science. So when you discover that that a person who you love very much has been keeping a secret from you and then covering up that secret with years of lies, those are two different things, Jeff. One is the secret, that is the bad thing that you're ashamed of and you don't tell. And then there are the hours, months, years, decades of lies. When you discover that you are the victim of that transgression, your life, it changes. Your future dies. Your past, you can't trust. But it's very hard to give up on the person who's done this because you've loved that person, and that person has loved you, even though there are transgressions.
You talk about the two basic roles of keeper and finder, and
yeah,
both lives are changed by the revealing of the secret. What are often the circumstances? Does the keeper often just get tired of keeping it? Are they finally undone by trying to multiply lies on top of the secret? I mean, what's the usual circumstance?
There are a number of circumstances. One is that the secret comes out not confessed. A letter, a clue, a phone message, emails. So there's evidence is one way that the secret comes out. And another way that the secret comes out is that the secret keeper finds him or herself in need of telling the truth to the person close to them. They just can't bear it anymore. And I think one of the things that I hope my book explains and helps people with is that the person who's been keeping the secret may look like a rat for having been a betrayer, but they've not been happy with their role in in the secret keeping. And I think that's important to understand.
So there's some compassion, obviously, for the secret keeper, but it also stems from your own story, and you begin with yourself in this book. What happened to you with your husband, Dick?
Well, you know, we'd been married for 15 years. Dick was a psychoanalyst, and I was a book editor. And one night at the end of a psychiatric meeting, we were in San Francisco, he came back from a party, and he said, "I have something to tell you." And I said, "What is it?" And he said, "I'm homosexual." At which point, it was, if imagine yourself in a car, you're driving, and somebody hits the windshield with a bat. That's what happened to my future. It fragmented. And we talked all night, and we talked all the way home on the plane, hugging and crying, and we decided to stay married, partly because our sons were 9 and 13, and partly because he needed the cover of being married, because at the time homosexuality was considered an illness in the psychiatric and psychoanalytic community. And I stayed married because I didn't want to raise my kids without their father, and I wanted to keep the family, even if it was no longer the family I thought it was.
So interesting. You went from a secret being kept from you to being, well, I don't know, the word accomplice. Yeah, you became
a keeper. No, I went from being a finder to a keeper in 10 minutes. And the finding, Dick had lied to me for nearly 20 years, but then I lied to the world and my children for another 10.
Wow. And then what finally undid the secret all around?
Well, our older son got a clue. And he called his dad and said, "What's this about?" And so we told him. And his response was, "I've been living a lie." And he left. He was out of college. He left the house, slammed the door, and we didn't hear from him for weeks. The younger son we told when he came home from college, and he was less upset. And when his brother called and said, "Would you like to come down? He lived in the village, and talk with me," our younger son said, "You know, I don't want to leave the house because I don't want Dad to think I don't love him."
Interesting. Very different reactions from those two finders. Yeah.
Yeah.
Jane Isay is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Secrets and Lies. And I want to ask Jane, once you move beyond your own story, how did you find all the other people whose stories you tell in the book?
It's a miracle. I went to the people whom I had interviewed from my previous books. By this time, I've done hundreds of interviews, and I've met wonderful, wonderful people all over the country. And they helped me they helped send me some people that they thought might want to talk with me. It takes an act of great trust and courage to talk to a stranger about a secret that you've been told or that you've kept. But gradually, over time, I was able to amass enough people who gave me that gift, and it wasn't easy. I almost didn't write the book at some point because I couldn't figure out how to find more people. Then I wrote a piece in the New York Times about staying married for the children, and I got a big response from people who read that and offered to be interviewed.
Excellent. It's a good way to beat the bushes, as it were.
You bet.
For more stuff. The first chapter is about birth bombshells, the idea that people find out they are not who they thought they were, at least their parents aren't who they thought they were.
Yes.
Are these generally older stories? I guess I work in this thinking that adoption has changed quite a bit in the world today.
Yes, it has. But there's a new twist to it that isn't in the book because it's not grown up enough, and that's the artificial insemination children.
Mm-hmm.
There's something really happening there, and it's not so much. A lot of parents don't tell their children that they've used artificial means, and because there's no witness, you know, there's no birth parent who knows about this. And it's a heavy burden. And now, people whose birth was caused by these artificial means are looking for their biological parents because they need to know the genetics. And these records are as secret as the old adoption ones were.
Interesting.
So there's going to be a new. Just watch this. It's going to happen.
So if there's a second edition of Secrets and Laws, that's going to be someplace to be looking there.
You bet.
The first story you tell is, and each chapter, I have to tell the listeners, seems to include an example of a case where people kept the secrets and then even after they were revealed, still sort of stonewalled further.
Yeah.
So not necessarily great outcomes there, but better outcomes in cases where people really did come clean. So you start with the story of Naomi, who got an anonymous letter as an adult. You related a bit of this story earlier. What are the forces that work on the keeper in such a situation?
Shame and more shame, and then a little more shame, and the anger of the person who has been betrayed and keeps knocking on that wall saying, tell me the story, tell me the story. And it's really a problem. If something is revealed to you and you're not given the circumstances, you can't have the empathy for the person who's done this. If you get the circumstances, either from the people who, in Naomi's case, the people who adopted her, or in Maria's case, from relatives, you can understand things. You can put things in context. You know, the human brain is a context maker, right?
Mm-hmm. But, relates to patterns, sure.
Yeah, and so you see a pattern. We tell ourselves the stories of our lives. We see a pattern. We tell a story. We find some peace. But where there is ambiguity, there is no peace. And this runs through the book. If you're keeping a secret and you've decided to tell it, prepare for anger and for rage and for distance, and then prepare yourself to tell the whole story. That's the way to heal.
Why do you suppose Naomi's parents, or what reasons did they give to her for, once she knew that she was adopted, for stonewalling further and continuing to kind of string her along?
They said they were very busy, and they didn't have time to talk with her. They said it was too painful. Now, I did not talk to Naomi's parents, as you can imagine.
Right.
They weren't talking. I think what happened there is that Naomi was so hurt by the fact that they didn't jump to explain themselves, that every hour and every day that they weren't telling her, she got madder and madder. So the two sides, because of the silence to begin with, they had a very hard time getting together. Naomi thought that they were too self-involved, and they said they were busy and she didn't count enough. She also felt that she had always been treated differently in the family from her two sisters, who were biological children of this couple. And so the fact that she was adopted and she found out it from an anonymous letter, and the fact that she had been treated differently, and she checked with her high school friends and they said, oh yeah, they really did treat you differently, and the fact that they couldn't really sit with her and talk it through, it really hurt her deeply.
We're talking to Jane Isay about her book, Secrets and Lies, Surviving the Truths That Change Our Lives, about the circumstances of people who have discovered, people have been holding very, very big secrets from them over the years. And so they went from talking to the keeper of the secret to becoming a finder of the secret. And we'll talk about those relationships more as the program goes on. You can join this at 800-838-3760, anywhere you can hear us. In the Rogue Valley, it's 541-552-6782. And our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So by contrast, Naomi's parents kept stonewalling further, too busy, can't talk to you, blah, blah, blah. Maria, secretly adopted by her mother's sister, this ended up working out a great deal better for her.
Yes, it did. And I think the reason it worked out better. So here's the story. Maria is sitting looking at snapshots with her dad. He says, I love you, Maria. She says, yes, Dad. He says, I love you as much as if you were my daughter. Well, her father denied having said that the next morning.
I was drunk or something?
No, he was 80.
Uh-huh.
But at that time, 80 was 80. Now 80 is the new 60. But in those days, and all of her relatives said, oh, we don't know anything about it, except one cousin. She said, what do you know about this? And he said, I was sworn to secrecy by my mother before she died. So Maria knew there was a secret. And what she did was, actually, what Naomi had done, you know, there are social workers and people who will help you find your birth parents. There are these networks of people who help adopted children. And so she found out who her mother was. Well, her mother was her aunt. She'd gotten pregnant during World War II, and she couldn't keep the, she didn't know what to do with the baby, so her sister and brother-in-law took Maria in. Then she found her birth father, who lived in Arkansas or Missouri, And she went to visit him, and they were not the literate, book-reading, upwardly mobile family that she grew up in. And so when she got home, and her birth mother said, "You better not tell anybody. I've got a shotgun on my lap," because, of course, her biological mother's husband never knew she'd been pregnant.
Oh, okay.
So when she got home, when all of this was done, she saw the picture. It happens all the time. The sister gets pregnant. The sister and brother-in-law take the child. She was grateful to the parents who raised her for having brought her up so well. She's a reader. She said, "I can always remember my mother would leave me out on the stoop of our brownstone, and I'd wait for the bookmobile." This is really important. So that really helped the family. Now, in the third case, the story of the woman whose mother said, "Your father isn't as dead as I told you," It took her 10 years to track him down. And she became a crack, award-winning investigative reporter in those 10 years. When she found him, it turned out he did not know that she had been born. And he said, "But your mother had a miscarriage." And Annie said, "Oh, well, yes, she miscarried, but she was carrying twins, and I'm the one who survived." Well, he welcomed her into the family. She got sisters, she got nieces and nephews. Her mother said that she had told this man with whom she had fallen in love in Florida, and he said he never knew. So there was a big ambiguity there. She knew who he was. Her mother had told her the story of getting pregnant, but her mother swore that she told him, and she let him know, and he never came to her. She waited for him at the hospital and so on, and he swore he didn't know. And this was hard, because ambiguity, as I said, is the hardest thing. But on her deathbed, her mother confessed that she hadn't actually told him, the father. She told the father's mother.
Wow.
Well, the mother wasn't going to tell her son that he had a... She wanted him to live the life that she wanted for him.
Wow. So it seems like, you know, secret keepers can sort of multiply themselves.
They can. And you know, what we're all... You know, I don't... I hope that the stories I'm telling you and our conversation makes it clear that there is no judgment here in me.
Mm-hmm.
We're all human beings. We make mistakes. We are full of shame sometimes. We don't know what to do. We hear bad things. Our hearts are broken, and we want to mend. And so this is a book about broken hearts and mending them.
Let's take a call from Sandy in Mount Shasta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. The book is Secrets and Lies, the author Jane Isay.
Yeah, hi. Wow, what a fascinating title. And Jane,
thank you
so much for writing this book. And I'm so glad that you identified that the glue that keeps secrets in place is the emotion of shame.
Yeah.
Which I think is a subject that our culture tries to avoid looking at all costs. And I do mean at all costs, because I think it costs us tremendously.
I agree.
When we have an unwillingness to normalize the experience, it keeps us from facing the truths. It would actually allow us to learn from and grow from if we could actually face them. And I believe you mentioned denial earlier.
Yes.
And I'm pretty sure, and I believe that shame is what fuels denial on all levels, from the very personal to the social and historical. We rewrite history to conveniently leave out, in a given culture, all the most shameful events, the things that if we had to face them, we would cringe because we don't know how to face them.
Yeah.
That's, I think, the growing edge for our culture.
Thanks again
for writing that book.
All right, thanks, Andy.
Well, thank you, and thank you for your comments. I think you're right. I think that shame is at the root of all of this. And as cultures evolve, different things are shameful. And I also agree with you that the energy that it takes to keep a secret is a lot. It takes energy, and you don't have you don't have infinite energy. The energy it takes to be in denial, it takes a lot. Once the truth is out, you stand on the hard ground, and you can stand straight. You can be angry. You can have all the responses you want. But as I say in my book, the mantra is, at least I know.
I get the sense, though, that people don't give it up easily. There's not like an, oh, well, you got me. I'll tell you everything now.
Oh, I mean, no. You're right.
All right. Much more to talk about with Jane Isay. The book is Secrets and Lies, Surviving the Truths That Change Our Lives. We'll talk more with Jane and take your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the author Jane Isay. Her third book is Secrets and Lies, Surviving the Truths That Change Our Lives. It's about people keeping some very heavy-duty secrets over the years and what they went through holding those secrets and what the people they were keeping them from, the finders, went through when they finally found out. Join our discussion on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere you can hear us, in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. I want to pick up the thread from before the break. You were saying then that it is generally not a case that once people are found out, the secret is discovered and somebody confronts the keeper. They're not going to tell the finder everything right on that first session.
No, and I think, again, it's really hard. You've been keeping a secret for decades. You have built up your own set of explanations for yourself. You know, we want to feel like good people. So if we're doing something that we know isn't quite kosher, well, we say, I'm doing it for him, I want to protect that. And all those layers of self-justification have built up like the barnacles on a ship, so that when the secret comes out, those barnacles haven't gone away. And it takes time if you want to keep the relationship. Now, there are people who have, in marriages, where when the secret that they're having an affair comes out, it's really a key to an exit. So they're not so interested in coming clean because they really want to stop the marriage. And that's another animal
altogether. And then there's a whole chapter on affairs and infidelity. There's a chapter before that, though, about the stranger at the funeral, which is an interesting set of circumstances. I think we can stipulate that it's just plain sad to have reunions or first-time unions at funerals. But this concept of, hi, I'm your half-brother that you never knew existed, things like that. It's some crazy stuff. The story of Amy is one of the ones that really stands out, separated by divorce from her father.
Yeah.
And then things moved on from there.
Such a touching story. So her parents divorced. They lived in a small town. And her mother, she and her sister and her mother, moved in with her mother's family. And they said, we'll take you in and support you so long as you never see that rascal again. And they never saw their father again. And the mother said, oh, his family doesn't care about us. They've moved away. And they grew up in a very fine home, very kind of... very genteel home. And then Amy was visiting an aunt, and the phone rang, and it was her father's sister saying that he was on death's door. Now, Amy didn't know anything about it, but he died, and she and her sister went to the funeral, and there they found a whole other family. Now, this family had not hated these girls. As a matter of fact, the aunts had gone to the performances of the dance performances and the little music halls where these girls performed. They sat in the back because they didn't want to disturb the family as it had been reconstituted. And then there was this blonde woman, and that was her stepmother, and she recognized her immediately. Her father had owned a movie theater, and sometimes she would sit on the lap of the woman who took the tickets, and that was the woman. And she said, I remember you. You were so beautiful. And she said there were a lot of blondes at the time, which made me think that she knew that this man was a player at the time. And then she looks across the funeral parlor, and there is somebody who looks like her father, the last time she had seen him, and it was her half-brother. And they ran to each other, and they hugged, and they wept, and they spent all the time they could together. And as a result of this, she got a second family, she and her sister, and they're more like her than the family that she was raised in. They like partying, they like dress up, they're a little louder.
Mm-hmm.
So she found a part of her, why she was the way she was. Her mother would say, Amy, how could you be that way? Well, when she found her, the other half of her family, she knew the answer to that.
So a real enrichment in her life from the secret finally being revealed.
Yes, and they were really mad at their mother for a while. But then the mother relented, and now she says she never said anything bad about her ex-husband's family. We rewrite history, you know.
Boy, it really is revisionist then, huh? Yeah, I never did that. No.
Not me. I never said a word. And the beauty of this story is that Amy had her sister. So this was not, I'm crazy, you're crazy, I never said it. Because she would say, I never said a word, and the sisters would exchange that glance.
Is this the procedure you refer to as the emotional double axel? Where you're still not telling the truth, but it's a better lie than...
That's right.
Yikes. Let's take some more calls. We have Edward in Ash Valley on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jane Isay, the author of Secrets and Lies.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for the book and the topic. I just think there needs to be something said about our culture of denial.
Mm-hmm.
I think it began with the know-nothings. You're familiar with those people,
of
right?
Course,
of course. And the political.
Yeah, okay.
Movement.
Well, it started with that concept. You know, I have, you know, they're going to not tell you the truth to protect their private advantage, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing is the Holocaust, the North American Holocaust, you know, and all the lies and everything. And then... The children of a lot of those people, a lot of pony soldier children, you know, victims of rape and whatnot, you know, have grown up. And then what do they know? You know, it's like we're products of parenting and schooling. So now today I see us, as in we the people today, as a damaged people.
Interesting.
You know, we're either healing someone or we're getting healed ourselves.
All right. Thanks for that, Andrew. So he's dealing on a macro scale. The book is more on a micro scale. But, I mean, is he onto something in thinking that we have denial in our relationships because we're deniers as a country?
Well, I think we have denial in our country because it's a human dynamic. He's totally right. I agree with him about everything. And as we've looked at the way in which history has been revised and is taught, over time, more and more and more of the truths come out, but the denial of cruelty, the denial of shameful acts, begins at the beginning of time, and it takes so much energy out of the culture and out of the country to act as if we have not, our forebears and we have not behaved shamefully. It's a problem. It's a great problem. But what I see is in the home once the door is shut. Those are the secrets I'm interested in, really. But I agree with him.
Let's take another call from Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jane Isay. Her book is Secrets and Lies.
Well, he stole my thunder.
Oh.
Oh, did he?
He was going in exactly the same direction, so I'll tell you a family secret.
Yes.
I'm young and good-looking.
I think we're going to have to work on that one, too.
Okay, so seriously, there is something to that, because those macro lies affect us on a personal level.
They do.
You know, and if a person can justify their behavior by saying, and I do my best not to lie, and that is the truth. The long and the short of it is, if my government is lying to me, why should I tell the truth?
Well, you know, I think that's a good question. The answer is you should tell the truth because you are accountable to yourself. That's what I think. I also think that one of the things I discovered, I couldn't put it in the book because it didn't quite fit, was I interviewed a lot of baby boomers whose fathers came home from World War II, greatest generation heroes, and they were so damaged by their experiences in the war. In both on the European front, but especially the Pacific, and their wives sent away charming, laughing men, and they got back brooding alcoholics. And because the Greatest Generation couldn't talk about their experiences, and nobody knew about PTSD and so on, a cloud hung over that whole generation. The secrets of the pain of war. It's one of the longest kept secrets in human history.
And that generation in particular came back to a real stiff upper lip kind of like,
come on.
They did,
and they were heroes, and they got free education, so how could they complain?
Right, all kinds of things that layered on top of that. Let's go to Jeannie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jane Isay.
Hi. three people can keep a secret if two of them are dead. I'm sure you've heard that. That's not that funny, but it is. Loose lips sink ships. I married a fellow, a second marriage, who had four children. Eventually, we raised the children, and he told me a couple years later, well, the oldest two boys I adopted with my first wife. I said, what? I said, well, do the other two kids know that their two older brothers are adopted? He said, no. Why, you never told them? I mean, I gave up a child for adoption in 1970-something, and I've met her, and it's not like the Oprah show always, but it is now. So anyway, now my stepkids are 40s, in their 40s, and have their families, and my stepdaughter says, yeah, I always wondered why those two boys had blonde hair and we had black hair.
Well, that's a wonderful, what you've just told, and thank you for your story, is really common. Kids wonder why they look different. You know, some kids who are all the same, biological brothers and sisters think they're adopted because they don't go along with the family so much.
Mm-hmm.
But finding a secret like that, finding the truth, it's like your skin fits for the first time, and that's another benefit of learning the truth about, particularly about your parentage.
Thanks for that call, Jeannie. So, Jane, when you relate the stories of families that have been separated by divorce, or kids have been adopted, and things like that, and these are cases where the finders really didn't have an opportunity to know because they were just being born in some cases.
Yes.
But when you get into infidelity and affairs, you're really talking about a case of where people can know.
Mm-hmm.
But as you pointed out earlier, there's a lot of denial here, and people really sort of delude themselves.
Yes, and I think the psychological mechanism that explains that is something called cognitive dissonance, which is you made a decision and you're determined to keep believing that decision is the good one. So, and one of the experiments in cognitive dissonance that's so fascinating is they believe, they've done experiments on this, people who join fraternities, that hazing process is very important to their loyalty because they're thinking, well, if I went through this, it really must be worth it. I think maybe big weddings are the same thing. Hazing processes for marriages?
Seriously?
Well, I'm of course not seriously, but I when you're committed to something and you think you've made the right decision, you're not going to notice the information that's right in front of your nose, and that isn't because you're stupid or weak. That's because it's how your brain works.
You know, when you talk about hazing, though, for fraternities, it makes me think about this story of Donna with a physically abusive husband who was committing infidelities on her. And I have to wonder if sometimes the bond, and here we go back to the fraternities thing, if the kind of physical abuse that you don't want to reveal to anybody, that's a secret you keep, is maybe something that they're onto something with hazing. It's like you're going to keep the loyalty of the organization because you've been abused.
That's right.
Wow.
That's right, and that, you know, and then you get into it's not in the book, and it's not a secret, the Stockholm syndrome, and you know, and yes.
So what happened to Donna? I mean, how did she let her husband define her?
Well, you know, she really, really, this is a very gifted woman, and quite successful until she gave it all up to try to keep her husband happy. She really, really wanted to stay married, and she really, really, really wanted to keep up the facade. And so when his reality was, you're ugly and dumb and you were a bad mother, and her reality was, I'm not ugly, I'm not dumb, and I'm great at parenting, in order to keep things level, she had to start believing him that she wasn't so good. And all of it was because she loved him and she thought she would be married to him forever, and she eroded her confidence in herself. You know, the painted desert, well, that wind and sand,
mm-hmm.
erodes a person's confidence. And I can tell you it happened to me in the 10 years that I stayed married to Dick. You don't believe you are as valuable if you are not being valued by the person you love.
So it really, the process of keeping the secret, even keeping somebody else's secret, just ends up working the same sort of...
It does.
Chews you up from the inside.
Yeah.
And we don't have time to talk about it here, but I certainly urge people to get the book because it's a whole other story that we haven't talked about with Jane and a different husband and how things worked out there. And it's good reading, well-written book all around, Jane. I can tell you spent many years in the publishing business.
Oh, thank you.
And thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much.
You bet. This evening, Jefferson Public Radio will broadcast live coverage of President Obama's State of the Union address to Congress and the nation. The coverage begins at 6 p.m. Depending on which service you listen to, you have a pair of choices on the coverage. Here on JPR's News and Information Service, we will carry the BBC World Service coverage of the speech and the political responses. Over on the Classics and News Service of JPR, the coverage will come from NPR. So that's President Obama and the State of the Union tonight starting at 6, BBC coverage here on the News and Information Service, NPR coverage on our Classics and News Service. If Classics and News Service not available where you are, you can always find any one of our services, online at ijpr.org. And that'll do it for today's Jefferson Exchange. Tomorrow on the Exchange at 8 o'clock, we'll talk to the folks from Citizens for a Safe Ashland about their campaign to curtail gun ownership in the city. In our Vents Day segment, we'll talk about plastic bags. California's talking about a statewide ban. We'll talk about Oregon beefing up its anti-smoking campaigns because it got low grades from the American Lung Association. And then we'll talk about how to approach healthcare professionals as we talk to the author of the book, Excuse Me, Doctor, I've Got What? She is a doctor herself. That's all tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer is Charlotte Duren. Our student assistant at the controls today is Reed Newland. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you again soon on another edition of the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of IJPR. Have a great day.